Hi, and welcome to 20 Minutes of Teaching Brilliance on the Road with Trust-Based Observations. Today, I have with me Jolene Bolter, an amazing teacher at Ober Elementary School in Las Vegas, Nevada. I was able to watch her 2, 3, 4 weeks ago teaching an amazing math lesson. And so I'm going to give Jolene a chance to say hi and introduce herself. So hi, Jolene.
Hello. Yes, I'm Jolene Bolter. I teach math and science, departmentalized math and science in fifth grade at Ober Elementary. And thank you again for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you, Jolene. I'm so grateful that I get to see amazing teaching. And now with the start of the podcast, have a chance to share it out. So as teachers, we can learn from each other and all help each other grow. So I'm really grateful to you for giving all our listeners out there a chance to be able to learn from you and what we saw that day. So as we talked a little bit beforehand, and we've been having a little bit of technical difficulties, and this is our third run through, one of the things that we've learned is this is a second career for you. So do you want to maybe talk about your first career and how you got to where you're at and maybe your history of teaching up to this point?
Sure. I was a complex commercial litigation paralegal for 20-ish years. And when my youngest son was getting ready to graduate high school, I decided it was time to do something that was more, that would feed me a little bit more. And so this ended up being the place that I landed, and it was a really great choice.
So we're thinking about teaching a little bit, but tell me how exactly that happened, that, you know, you wanted something more meaningful. There could have been lots of things. How did it come to be teaching?
I was talking with a group of friends, actually, and one of them was a fifth grade teacher. And he said, I think that you'd enjoy it. Come sit in my classroom and observe. And I did. And that was all she wrote. I knew that's what I wanted to do. I felt the calling, and it was the right choice. It was one of the best decisions I've ever made.
So you went and finished whatever schooling you needed to get ready to become a teacher. And boom, did you know, like fifth grade, did that appeal to you right away because that's the one you saw, or did it just turn out that way?
So I started in third, which I loved because it's such a fun year. They grow so much. And then at one point we had a fifth grade position open up at my prior school, and I felt like I needed a new challenge, and it made sense. And then once I got into the fifth grade classroom, I knew that, okay, I love that they have this independence and they have a little bit of sass and they're ready to give a little bit and you can joke around and all of the fun stuff that we get to do with fifth graders.
Right. They're in that just in between age that seems just right in so many ways, right?
Yeah.
That's great. Well, the day that we were watching you, it was pure joy. We looked up and 20 minutes were over because there are 20 minute unannounced observations. We're like, where did the time go? When we walked into the classroom, the very first thing that stood out to me was just the buzz. We walked in and you've got whiteboards on the wall all over the whole classroom spread out. And I'm not sure how many kids you have, but it must have been 8, 10 groups of three spread out across the room working on the whiteboards and looked like they were teaching and learning from each other. Can you tell us like what they were doing and what that's about in your room? Because my understanding is that's a pretty regular part of what goes on in your class.
Yep, that's what instruction looks like most of the time. We have three roles at the boards. They are thinker, writer, and coach. So each of the kids, we define those roles together and what it means, what those roles mean, and how we should behave and what's correct and what's not correct. At the beginning of the year, we do a lot of work just defining what that behavior should look like. And then they get rolling with it and they go. And so we do a little bit of direct instruction where we put up our success criteria and what we want to learn for the day. And then we set them loose and they go.
So what I'm hearing you say is, one, there's always a little bit of direct instruction because the kids have to know what the learning objective is and then what the success is going to look like. But then even as I hear you talk about the thinker, say it again, thinker, coach,
thinker,
writer.
Coach and writer,
Thinker, coach, and writer, that as that's going on, really what's going on in a lot of that is there's a lot of peer assessment of each other, peer-to-peer assessment. And so one of the things that anybody that does peer assessment well knows is with this age of a student, we have to really prepare them. We can't just expect that they're going to get it right from the beginning. And so you're front-loading expectations and behavior, and I'm sure even practicing how that goes. You want to maybe talk a little bit more about that? Because that's so vital, I think, in setting them up for success when you're doing an activity like that.
Yeah, my math teaching partner and I read the book Building Thinking Classrooms by Peter Liljedahl, and it kind of sets up those roles and what they should look like. And the original rubric how you create it with the students so that they have ownership in it. And then we create those. We create those. And then, yeah, we do a little bit of direct instruction. And then everything else is through discovery, which we've learned also, one, if you're standing, your brain engages in a different way. And if you're on a non-permanent surface, your brain engages in a different way. So those were the things, the big takeaways, the studies that they did in preparation for writing that book were. And once we saw it working, we're like, oh, here we go. This is something. And yes, absolutely. So if a student doesn't understand a concept, they're the writer to start. If someone feels like they have a strategy that will work, they're the thinker. And then the coach is just checking to make sure that all of the actual math that we're doing is correct. And then they switch roles. So once we get rolling, we make sure, walk around and make sure we see different handwriting. We swap the marker. And they're really good at it by now. They all know that usually one problem, one person's writing, and then we hand the marker off and we switch roles.
So it looks like it, as that's going on and the students are taking on the different roles, it feels like there's a lot of teaching others going on too. Is that a regular part of the process?
Yeah, absolutely. Because one, true mastery, if we look at our standards, is that explain, right? And justify, which you have to do when you are teaching somebody else. So, and we kind of talked to them about that at the beginning of the year. This is how you know that you know material, right? If you can teach somebody else, that's a sign that you actually have grasped it. And you don't even have to talk to me about that. You know it yourself. So yeah, the thinker is the one that is describing what they're doing. The coach checks that math. And then the writer is taking in that information and learning as they write from the person that's doing the thinking.
And so as they're doing that and as they're rotating roles, if somebody's not getting it, maybe as opposed to a more traditional style where they're all just working individually, they're generally being able to be corrected really quickly by their peers. Or perhaps if they don't have the answer, like if nobody in the group is sure, then what do they do?
Then the first thing that they do is check other groups. And sometimes they'll say, well, the coach thinks it's this answer. And they've given their reason. They've respectfully disagreed. And the thinker think it's this answer, but we can't figure it out. And then they go check other boards and have those conversations with other classmates. Again, because if you can argue and you can justify why your answer is correct, we're showing mastery. And we can understand. Those aha moments happen all the time when they go and talk to another group of kids. And they're like, oh, I just didn't regroup this 100.
And so much more powerful too when they're learning from each other on their own as opposed to being told. I mean, there's so much going on in what you're saying, Jolene, because there's teaching others, there's descriptive progress feedback, there's discovery, but it's all on their own with each other, which is so much more powerful than us just doing it on our own or being told the answer in terms of what's going on. One of the things that maybe we were talking about a little bit before too is we talked about prepping them with like how we work constructively with each other, but you even talked a little bit to me earlier about how they prep each other. You prep them on productive struggle and when it's the right time to go get help. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit and unpack that as well? Because I think that's an important piece for a teacher to help their students.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's different for each kid, right, too. That's the thing. You know, it's different. And so we have to identify. We have to identify what it feels like and what it looks like. So we kind of make a chart of what success looks like and what success feels like and what it feels like along the way so that they can understand that, hey, I'm on the road to success and right now I'm plateauing and I need to find a way to get rolling again.
So when you do that, Jolene, is that just you're telling the kids what that looks like or is that you're working that out and discovering that with them together at the beginning? How does that piece itself together?
So at the very beginning, we create a rubric of what board work looks like. And we define what those behaviors look like. And the kids do it. And we do it by going to the boards and we give them no guidance the first couple of days or for at least the first time, no guidance. You go to the boards and then we come back and say, what went well? What didn't? And then they diagnose themselves what didn't work and how it could work better. And then we build to that rubric each day and they each pick a goal. So I want to make sure that I'm passing the marker. I want to make sure that I'm engaging even when it's not my turn to think. All of those things. And then those behaviors just become rote as you continue to do it.
So just little mini goals for them along the way. I must imagine, and I think this is really important for teachers out there, that when you're doing those first couple of days and you're just letting them go without any rules and you're watching some chaos, and I'm imagining perhaps some disaster, perhaps some arguments going on. Like, tell me how you get through that part with knowing that's going to get you to where you go, where you just must be dying to jump in.
Yeah. So basically, we go to the boards and come back a lot. So now in our lessons, they're pretty much self-sustaining for 20 to 45 minutes, depending on the lesson. But at the beginning, sometimes it's 1 minute and we come back into the middle of the room and we have discussion about what went well and what didn't. And again, it's not me saying, hey, please don't do that. It's them defining the behavior and then giving us, we have the accountability talk on the wall so they can say, I disagree with you because, or instead of saying you're wrong, so that we don't shut down. You know, all of those things take a couple of weeks to build and really don't really start flying until like 6 weeks.
So that's that teaching them the appropriate peer-to-peer descriptive progress, feedback, interaction, behaviors. But like when you, I just kind of imagine like, maybe not now because you've been doing it a little bit, but the very first year you did this and they're, you're just giving them, I mean, having them go at it without the rules really being established, and you know it's to get to a point, right, where you're getting them to understand what is and isn't working, which helps to build the understanding and rubric for what that goes. But I can't imagine the first year or two, like if somebody knew was going to be doing this, you just got to be chomping at the bit to jump in. Tell me how you don't do that.
So you have somebody good with you. So I have an amazing fifth grade teaching partner, and we did it together. We read the book together. We made our map. We made our goals together, and then we talked every day. Like after the first couple of days, oh my God, what are we going to do about this? How can we do this in a way that they're buying in? And the book is really great at, and that community is really great at giving you ideas when you hit a wall or when you have, you see behavior. And I know that the first couple of weeks, people were saying, oh, just keep going with it, keep defining, keep with the rubric, having them self-assess. And we'll get there. And I'm like, I don't know. Because we did it last year. It was our first year. I'm like, I don't know. But it did. We got there. You know, we definitely got there. And it takes, we don't have kids disengaging and not doing math, right? Which is what would happen after 7 minutes of direct instruction. Often you would start to see those kids kind of dropping off. And we don't have that anymore, which is really nice.
So some of what I hear you saying, Jolene, is that as you're starting this new, is that one, having a partner and a sounding board to be able to, who's experiencing the same things, because you've just got to be biting your tongue. And there's got to be a feeling at the very first sometimes like, oh no, this is worse than before, right? And so 100%. Having an understanding almost that they're a little implementation dip, but I heard you saying persevering, sticking through, having grit or whatever, knowing that it'll get there. Like those are some of the key components. And then obviously the advantage of that, if I'm hearing you correctly, is then because the kids are making their own discoveries and then they're the ones that are creating, and you are knowing to even so stop it quickly before it gets too out of control and bring them back.
Right.
And all of that. And then power in what's being created because they've created it themselves. Am I hearing all that correctly?
Yeah. And I think that as you go through the school year, the kids get to a different trust with you as well. Right. So you've always have that handful of kids that you've got to prove yourself to because they're not ready to trust you or trust you enough to fail, right? That's the big thing that I like about the boards on the wall, because within 2 days, you're going to make a mistake and half the class is going to see it. So it really jump starts that trusting your classroom because everybody does it. Every single student sees it. So that's really helpful. It's painful, but it's helpful. And then once we get over the hump, it's a little bit easier.
So Jolene, how do you get to the kids? Does it just happen? I mean, do you talk about the failure and the getting to failure piece? Does it just happen? How do you get to the point where the kids are okay to fail and keep working, especially when it's in kind of on stage in a way, like on a mini stage? Yeah. How does that piece happen?
Well, I think that one thing that we both tried to do this year, because we did it last year for the first time, and this year, one of our goals together was that individual conversations with students. So once they start rolling to some extent, we want to talk to every kid for 3 to 5 minutes every 2 weeks. And we want to talk about academics and we want to talk about what's going on in their life. And that has led this process to go a lot more quickly because we gain that trust. Not only do they start trusting their peers, but their trust with us comes a little bit more quickly because they understand that we care about them more than just a mathematician, that we care about them as a whole kiddo.
So you're having individual conversations with each child. And as you're doing that and you're explaining what's going on and you're talking to them about it and mistakes, they get more comfortable and trusting. And that sort of makes them more okay with knowing that I'm going to make mistakes in front of other people. And so therefore accepting failure as just a normal part of the learning process, as opposed to a bad thing that I need to be embarrassed about. Am I hearing that right?
And another thing that we do is at the beginning, we celebrate our successes. So at the board, even if you had a really rough day at the board, find one thing that you're proud of. Find one thing that you'd like to improve on. So both of those things happening consistently, then they start not looking for failures. They start looking for success. And that mindset changes kind of everything.
Do you have them do that through like an exit ticket kind of thing? Or do they write it down? Yeah. Or do they just think about it? How does that manifest?
So for the boards at the beginning of the year, we make that rubric and it's looks like, doesn't look like, right? So at the beginning, they're doing looks like, doesn't look like, and then they're circling one thing they were proud of because we made that rubric together. There's like seven behaviors. And that's what that starts with. But then we transfer it over to actual content, right? So when my kids come to talk to me now, when they finish an assessment, they say, you know what? I got multiplying, but I don't have multiplying decimals because I don't understand the place value yet. And if they know, I'm not doing the heavy lifting, right? They're driving their own education. It's something that's going to sustain them for the rest of their life. So I'm really pleased. And again, that's something we started this year and we were hoping that it would take root, and it really has. I'm really starting to see the payoffs.
Of them just learning from each other and taking it on and being, I mean, that's so amazing if you think about it. And you have a variant of kids, but that because they're working with each other, that they can take on that failure and know that my teacher's not bailing me out. Not that, of course, they know you're there to support them, but that they're going to learn it on their own and from their peers. There's a whole nother level of power for the student. And not just in the math learning, but just in themselves and their esteem and grit and perseverance, right? All that.
Yeah. And then the kids scaffold the instruction for each other for different levels of learning in such an authentic way that when we try to manufacture that, yes, we can do a good job. And as teachers, we do scaffold it and we do put in that supports for different learning levels, but they do it in a natural way that doesn't require us to talk and talk about it. It happens. And then those kids take that scaffolding back to their independent work and show what they've learned. And it sits with them differently.
Well, and I know when we were in your classroom, you talked to the kids about, you'll show some sample problems and you'll have, was it mild, medium, and spicy? Can you talk about that? Because I think that blends into this in a way, what you're going to do as well.
So we pick, and it alternates. Sometimes it's just one problem, depending on where we are in the curriculum and what they need to do. But as we continue through the curriculum, after the first or second lesson, then they have mild, medium, and spicy. And sometimes that spicy question is an end of unit question. And they've learned without me saying a word that medium is probably where they need to be. So that, and mild is, you know what, I'm getting my feet wet and I'm not yet ready to take this big bite. So I know that I can do this and I can do this successfully. And that's what I'm going to do today. And ironically, most of them pick medium or spicy. It's really interesting to watch it unfold because sometimes, depending on what we're doing, if we've had some frustration at the boards, we'll have the majority of the class pick mild or medium, but most days it's medium or spicy.
And somehow that ties into the whole trust and learning from each other thing where they're willing to push themselves to that far end of their zone of proximal development is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really been fun to watch. I'm so glad we read this book.
So when you're doing that too, does that also give you a sense though? Because I know you're watching everything that's going on, but of course at some point in time, you have to jump in and support in whatever way it does. And as I remember watching it that day, because you had them come to the carpet for like 2-3 minutes before they went back out and started working again. And that mild, medium, and spicy, I thought they gave the thumbs or a finger to demonstrate which one they did. And that, if I'm not mistaken, that gives you some information about who I might want to initially keep an eye on to support. Do you want to talk about that as well?
So also on the top of their success criteria, we have each of the goals for the learning lesson, whatever the intention is, or, and it says, I've got it, yes or not yet. So if it's not yet, that tells me that I need to help or I need to give them a little confidence boost. And then based on that feedback, that's how we determine who we're working with, if we need to do a little bit more independent small group instruction that day on that topic. And then we also have the kids that maybe have not mastered another standard and we're going to pull them back and give them some instruction on that. So usually we try to do at least one of each. Sometimes if things are going great, a couple, try to get through three groups. But for the most part, they are able, and they have no issue now saying not yet, and they have no, and they're very proud when they say yes.
But, and again, that comes down to trust, right? You've built enough trust that it's okay for them to say they don't have it and know that's okay. And then again, because it's not just you helping them, but because they can learn almost more immediately from their peers, they don't have to sit in that struggle period that's the overwhelming part too long before they're getting the help. And that, I just think that's just such a massive difference in helping those kids to build success.
Yeah. And one of the recent webinars that in this thinking classroom group that we were part of said, if they can identify mild, medium, and spicy, you're halfway there, because they at least know the content enough to know that this is a harder problem and this is where I should be. And this is, you know, my stepping stone. So knowing, even if they can identify them, that gives me data immediately, instant feedback. And then again, once they do the problem, hey, I've got this part of this learning attention, but I don't have this part. So yeah, it's really empowering.
It's so interesting because, I mean, as we're sitting here and talking about it, and of course, I always think about things in terms of the trust-based observation, 9 areas of pedagogy, and we're filling in so much of it, just chatting it out here, because within formative assessment, we say there's 3 types. There's teacher formative assessment, peer-to-peer formative assessment, and student self formative assessment. And really, all 3 of those are going on almost constantly in your classroom, right? Just from what we're talking about. All 3 of those are just things that we've just described in the last 20 some minutes of our conversation. And then on top of that, we always have the descriptive progress feedback next to the formative assessment on the observation form. And so one of the other things that really stood out to me from watching in your classroom is when we talk about the types of descriptive progress feedback, and they all have value. The first is basic, where we're giving the students the answer to get them on track. The instructional is just those little tidbits of instruction that help guide them along the way. The one that I personally think is the most powerful is the coaching, where we're strictly using questions to get them going. And so as we watched in your classroom, I don't even think we could keep up with all the questions, but somehow, some way, your use of coaching and questions and tailoring each question to the level of each student was super, super impressive. Do you mind talking about your use of descriptive progress feedback, especially with the questions coaching piece?
So those mild, medium, and spicy questions that we identify, we identify them beforehand, so we know what we're looking for. And sometimes I'll throw them out and write 3 on the board because they've moved through whatever they're doing so quickly, or they need some scaffolding. They're not quite there, so we need to dial it back a little bit. But for the most part, it's again that student knowing what success looks like and how they're going to get there and what success feels like to them. And when they're working on a problem and they say, oh, I do know how to estimate, but I don't know what to do after I've estimated. I'm struggling with getting started on that. So those conversations, and most of the time it's, well, do you have an example in your notebook? Have you done this? Did you do this at the boards? What do you think you can do to get started? So most of the questions are inquiry based so that they take the action. And then there are times when kids are, it doesn't happen as much as it used to, but there are times when they're genuinely frustrated. We're just going to dial it back and bring you back and we're going to work on it, you know?
Which is okay. It's everything.
Absolutely.
That's why we said all different points along the way, and sometimes even finding a different way to reteach it to help the kid get there. But whenever possible, you're feeling them out along the way, and that's like the last resort, maybe isn't the right way of phrasing it. But whenever I can first get them to get there on their own, that's what I'm going to do. And then if we see ultimately that that's not there, then that's when I'm going to jump into to that other. Yeah. And you also probably have a sense of which kids are the ones that might need that a little more than others, because you're not getting to learn your students as well.
Yeah. And what I've learned too is that when we jump to small group too quickly, then that becomes a crutch to some extent for students. So making sure that we give them enough time to struggle and give them enough time to find, because a lot of times with math, it's just figuring out what your strategy and where you take the problem apart and what works for your brain, which is why having three different people at a board and thinking about it differently really helps foster that growth.
And then the ability, not only that, but then as you said, to, when I don't have it, to be able to go with the group, go seek out help from the group next to me.
Yeah. And what we've started in the last couple of weeks is we have a couple of students that we see kind of soaring and we are giving them those extensions. But what we've done is one of my students said, hey, you know, I noticed that you're helping some students at the table sometimes after the lesson's done. Can I do that? Absolutely. So now pretty much a student is leading another group, depending on where they are, while I'm leading another group right next to them. And just why not? Absolutely. Let's go. Let's do it.
Well, I mean, on, you know, we've got that pyramid on the form, the learning retention, and it starts with lecture direct instruction. Then it goes to audio visual and demonstration and modeling, which are all important, right? You have to have some of that along the way. And then it goes to group or team discussion, which that's what we're talking about. Really, almost everything that we're talking about right now, we're talking about learning by doing, which they're doing at the same time. And then within those three groups, and then even with those people leading those other groups, it's teaching others. And those bottom three, which is where you're spending like 90% of your time, that's that active learning where that's where the greatest retention and the real learning going on. I mean, you're living in that area with what you're doing with the kids.
Yeah. And I feel like this year, and this is anecdotal at this point, we'll see, the proof will be as we continue down and we get a little bit more data. But I feel like students have a better grasp of they understand what mastery is in a way that they haven't before. And they understand what tools can get them there. And they understand where they are on the mastery chart, right? Which is just, we can't ask for much more than that.
And that's all just building up over time what you're doing that. So you're educating them into, well, and they're experiencing it really, to learn what those are as you're explaining what it is all at the same time. And over time, their own understanding of that becomes their reality. And when you understand where you're at and then how to get there, what mastery is, yeah, then the process, especially when you're getting support from classmates, is so much easier.
I'm going to be honest too. I used to put objectives up on the board because we're required to do so, right? Yeah. And I do like inquiry-based, them finding their way to the objective. Yeah. I think there's value in that. But, and because we were required to district-wide this year, I had to find a way that made it meaningful and it wasn't just to meet some expectation. And yeah, I think, and again, my math teaching partner came up with some great ideas to where we are giving them that learning intention, which is important, but we're doing it in a way so that they're seeing success, what success looks like. And then they're going out, because we don't want mimics, right? We don't want mimics. I don't want you to do it the way that I'm doing it. I want you to find the way that works for you, because that's what you're going to be able to repeat when it comes time to show what you know.
Mm-hmm. So let's go one last piece on this, and that's the groups themselves. And so are those groups, like, are they heterogeneous groups? Are they homogeneous groups? Do they stay together for a certain period of time? How do those little teamings of three, we know they rotate roles within each day, so they're doing all three roles multiple times, but how do the groups form and function?
As they come in the door, we have cards that have, I do superheroes, and they have a different superhero on, which I shuffle the cards up. And then those superheroes are on each table, and that's where they go, and that's where they do their first round of board work with that group. And then I have a randomizer that I'll use if we need to do some more work, because if you work with somebody for 25 or 30 minutes, sometimes they're going to say something that's going to bug you and it's going to impede your learning. So giving them a chance to get with somebody other than the people that they were working with for that time, in case that's happened. And maybe getting with a group where I have a little bit more knowledge than the other two students at this group, and I get my moment to shine and share that knowledge that I have. So, and again, we took that from the book, and I have tried to make groups forever that I thought, you know, you sit there with a spreadsheet and you put them and you overthink them and you think that you finally got it. And then you put them, they go out into practice and you're like, well, that did not work. That did not work at all. And the first, like when we started with random groups, we saw less confrontation. We saw less one person doing the work, all of these things that we were looking for. And they know that even if they end up with somebody, because at the beginning of the year, they'll say, well, you know, last year, this person said something that I didn't like. So I'd rather not be in a group with them. And I said, we can do anything for 20 minutes, right? We can do anything for 20 minutes. So right. We're going to try. And getting them buying back into and building that community rather than closing that door on the community. And I don't get asked that anymore, which is surprising to me too.
That's amazing. So really just every day it's randomized. It's three different people. Sometimes some groups are going to work better than others, but no matter what, I'm learning to work with somebody for 20 minutes and there's value in that as a human being and in community. And even so, I still have a group to my left and to my right. So even if it's not an ideal group, there's help right available, but it sounds like because there's shorter groups and changing all the time, in some ways that ends up making it even more valuable and productive.
Yeah, and we don't really police group migration other than you have to, all your group members have to go with you. So if there have been a couple of times when we've been, you know, I'll throw out a really tough task where we're compiling some stuff that we've done all year and nine kids will get together around one board and start having a conversation. And I'm like, okay, this is awesome, right? This is what we want to see.
It's amazingly powerful. Jolene, thank you so, so much for sharing on all of this today. Can you one more time just name the book and the author again? We'll put it in the show notes as well.
Yeah. It's Building Thinking Classrooms by Peter Liljedahl.
It was joyful to watch. And now hearing it even more, I wish I could come back and watch it again, like every day for a week to really see it fully in action over an extended period of time. Do you do the same kind of thing in your science class as well?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can't imagine not running a classroom. And sometimes, you know, if you're doing experiments, you have to sit at a seat.
Sure.
But when we do the discovery questions, we throw them out to boards too. And they're not the groups that they were in for math. Mm-hmm. They're a different group. But yeah, and there are times when I'm like, okay, I think this concept, I need to do more direct instruction. I feel it. And every time I do it, I'm like, No, I did not. And it will happen maybe two or three times throughout the year where we're dealing with this complex problem. I want to make sure that I get what they need. And then I go, I don't remember how I taught before or how I could do this for, you know, sustained that direct instruction for those long periods of time because I can't make it through it.
But in a way, that's a really important point that I can't make it through it. But also it's an important point, that sense of I have to pull myself back from maybe the way that I went to school and I was taught to realizing, and then as you see this, it's still that urge is sometimes there. So I've got to pull myself back and go, no, I know I want to, but I can't. And the learning is more valuable. And that takes time and patience as well, right? And probably having your teaching partner, again, that relationship with them probably factors into that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And great guidance. We have great leaders at our school and we're really lucky to have the guidance because we went in the first year that we were working with Melissa and Charlotte and said, we read this book. We want to put boards around our room and not do direct instruction the way that we've done it. And they said, they read the book and they said, sounds great.
Isn't that great? That factors in too.
Yeah. And if it doesn't work, I think the words that you said, you'll fail forward. Mm-hmm. And having that said to you as the first time you walked into, she had only seen me teach one time, you know, and having that belief and that support is just, we're pretty lucky.
Well, and you, I hope you know that my belief is that as school leaders with teachers, we ought to be modeling the same thing we want our teachers to do with students. I mean, that's really what trust-based observations is about, is we want to be doing with you what we want our kids to be doing. And it sounds like, and I'm not surprised after spending a week at your school, that it's happening on both ends just the way we want it to. Jolene, yeah. Could you, for anybody that would like to reach out and maybe learn a little bit more from you if they have doing that, would you mind sharing like some contact information for our listeners
sure.
out there?
I am at Twitter and Instagram at Miss B, so MSB in class, both of those. And then quite honestly, if you want to just shoot me an email, it's Peter, P-E-T-E-R, J-K, at nv.ccsd.net.
Super. Thanks so much. Jolene, it was an absolute pleasure to listen to you today. And it was even more of a pleasure to get to watch you for those 20 minutes a couple of weeks back. So thank you so, so much for joining us today on 20 Minutes of Teaching Brilliance on the Road with Trust-Based Observations.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks, Jolene.
All right.